Allstate wants to remind fans that mayhem is everywhere. Like when your fantasy league meets up at your house. Everything's great until the hot plate gets too hot for the tablecloth. Now your kitchen's up in smoke. And if you don't have the right home insurance coverage, the cost to fix this is anything but a fantasy. So switch to Allstate, save money, and get protected from mayhem like this. Not available in every state. Based on coverage selected, subject to terms, conditions, and availability. Savings vary.
3, 2, 1.
When I'm working out, I love to listen to your podcast.
Whenever you say something, other people react to it.
Taking my breath away, Aaron.
Vern Lundquist joins me. Hall of Famer Jim Calhoun. NASCAR icon Dale Earnhardt Jr. Kirk Herbstreit is on the phone.
Here.
Welcome in, everybody. Episode 319 of the podcast. It is Sweeping America, the Aerator Sports Podcast. It is Monday, November 16th, 2020, people. I hope everyone had a great weekend. This is going to be a little bit of a different episode of the Aerator Sports Podcast, and here is why. I spent most of Sunday afternoon recording an incredible episode. One of the all-time greats. They will be talking about it. They'll throw it in the Smithsonian. It was so good. And then, the second that I hit finish, the second that I stopped my recording, Will Muschamp was fired at South Carolina. And so here is how we're going to do this show. I am going to open with Will Muschamp, get to it momentarily. We will pause. I will do a transition. And then basically, I'm just going to start the show over. Same thing. Welcome in. I'm amazing. Episode 319. Hope you had a great weekend. We have done this a few times in the past with breaking news. And listen, I just think it's the reality of what we're doing. I'm recording here on Sunday night in real time. And you get a little bit of the how the sausage is made with the Torres podcast. Sometimes you record midday Sunday and you get a great episode and you have plenty of time to prepare it for Monday morning. And then there are other times where something late breaking happens and you got to get into it. So this is episode 319. We will talk Will Muschamp, and then after Will Muschamp, very short break, a quick transition. We will get into everything going on in college football, mainly the conversations about a couple different things. First of all, the idea of postponing, canceling the season, pushing the season back. That has become kind of a narrative, is that we need to push the season back. I'll tell you why it doesn't happen. I will stay in the SEC, Will Muschamp's former home, the University of Florida. I believe they are slowly starting to emerge as a legitimate playoff contender, and at the very least, a team that nobody wants to see. We'll talk about Florida, and we will eventually also talk, of course, about Jim Harbaugh, because this is Wolverine Talk with Torres, where every single week I have to talk about Jim Harbaugh. But when the program hits new depths of failure every single weekend, that's just part of the deal. It's the biggest story in college football right now, outside of obviously Will Muschamp. And so because of it, it feels necessary that I do have to talk about Jim Harbaugh again. I apologize. I hope you'll forgive me. But let's get into Will Muschamp, and then we will start over and all that stuff. But Will Muschamp. So Sunday night, just living my best life, doing what AT does. Watching the NFL. I was actually watching college football because we had Cal-UCLA, which I'll talk about later in the show. Do the podcast. Everything goes great. It's an amazing episode, as I said. And then, right as I finish recording, Will Muschamp is fired at the University of South Carolina. I think in some regards, it's not shocking at all. And in some regards, it's very, very, very shocking after South Carolina lost on Saturday night at Ole Miss. Lane Kiffin, if you saw it, he threw his clipboard up in the air because he was throwing 70, 80, 90-yard touchdown bombs. His quarterback was anyway. And Lane Kiffin was having the time of his life out there. But I think it showed how far this South Carolina program had fallen, where a first-year head coach at a non-traditional power comes in, whips Will Muschamp's butt. I think that was the final nail, and I don't think it was ironic that this was the game where it happened, right? It's one thing if you lose to Bama and get smoked. It's one thing if you even lose to Georgia or Florida or whomever. But to lose to a non-traditional power, first-year head coach who's just throwing the ball all over the field and at the very least putting on a fun, exciting product, I think that really opened up the eyes to South Carolina's administrators and their fans, but he was fired. Now, in terms of the why it is surprising, let's start there. I think the reason it's surprising is because of the reason that I talked about on last Tuesday's episode. If you remember last Tuesday, I talked about Hugh Freeze and kind of the idea that he may potentially be a college football coaching candidate, and we'll get to Hugh Freeze in a minute. But when I talked about Hugh Freeze, I talked about the reality that in this era, in this moment in time in the pandemic, it's going to be really hard to fire people in college athletics, right? This isn't the professional ranks. These aren't privately owned teams. These are colleges and universities. They're places where people are, athletic departments, I should say, are cutting jobs left and right. I saw where South Carolina's own AD said that he believed that the school could lose upwards of $60 million, 6-0, about 58 and change if you want to be exact, because of the fact that they were not able to sell season tickets. They were not able to sell mostly tickets at all for this season. And because of it, when you lose $60 million in revenue that you were anticipating having, you're going to have to make cutbacks. You're going to have to lay people off. And so because of it, there's kind of this notion in college athletics that there were going to be no major firings this year. Maybe we'd see a situation like Jim Harbaugh. He leaves Michigan, goes to the NFL. They don't owe him any money. But the idea of paying a head coach millions of dollars to not coach your college football program was just something that I don't think a lot of people thought would happen this year. And South Carolina was certainly one of those instances, because South Carolina reportedly owes Will Muschamp around $13 million when they fired him on Sunday afternoon. And it really was one of those things where, because that number is so big, because the economy is so crazy, because frankly, boosters don't have the money that they once did because of this pandemic, there were a lot of people that really thought it wasn't going to happen. That is why it's surprising. Here is why it's not surprising, though. Have you seen Will Muschamp? He stinks. He's terrible. He's awful. And it really comes back down to what I said a minute ago. First of all, there's just the straight wins and losses, right? Like, I mean, that does matter. I don't think you can argue that even though South Carolina is not a historically great program, the bottom line is that he was in year five now, so it's not as though that he can argue, I need more time, I need to bring in my guys, I need to do this, I need to do that. Well, guess what? He basically flipped over his entire coaching staff last offseason. It's year five. He's got all his recruits in. You're basically out of excuses, and here we are. He was 2-5 this season. The only wins were against Vanderbilt early in the season and Auburn in a game that South Carolina easily could have lost. And like I said, when you go 28-30 overall, and that includes non-conference games, 17-22 in the SEC, it makes it hard for your school to justify keeping you in year five. I would go again back to what I said at the beginning as well. I don't think that the timing of this is ironic or accidental, with the fact that he was fired not only after a three-game losing streak, but in the manner in which South Carolina lost the last three games, right? Keep in mind, 3 weeks ago, they play LSU. LSU, and I understand, by the way, I believe this was a game that wasn't on the schedule that got added. It might not have been. They might have supposed to have been playing LSU. But the reason I bring it up is because they go to LSU. LSU is playing their backup quarterback. Never forget, their backup quarterback, not the starter. Again, I'm going to pull the Allen Iverson. I did it last week. I'll do it again. Not the starter. The backup. LSU puts up 52 points, beats them 52-24. You then, the following week, play Texas A&M. Texas A&M boat races you 48-3. And then, as I said, you lose on Saturday night to Ole Miss, at Ole Miss, where Lane Kiffin puts up almost 60 points on you. And so I think South Carolina started looking around and saying, now, wait a second. It's one thing if you're in your first year. It's one thing if you're in your second year. It's one thing even if you're in your third year. But when you're in year five and Jimbo Fisher has his program in a completely different stratosphere than you do in year three, that's not a good look. But, oh, you know, whatever. Texas A&M historically a little bit more successful in South Carolina. You can kind of say he inherited a better situation. He inherited an experienced quarterback with Kellen Mond. But I think when you follow that up, first of all, you lose to the backup quarterback against LSU. LSU has lost every game they've played since, which I believe they've gone 0-2 since then. You lose to Texas A&M in their coach's third year, but then you go to Ole Miss. First-year head coach, non-traditional power, struggling, not playing great at various points, although they beat Vandy going into the bye week, and you get boat race. You got Lane Kiffin throwing his play sheet up in the air because he is out scheming the crap out of you. I think that was just a cold glass of water in the face of South Carolina fans of like, it's one thing if we're not competing with Georgia and Florida. It's another thing if Ole Miss is doing whatever they want. And so because of it, I think we have a scenario where South Carolina just realized how far they're falling behind, but more than how far they're falling behind, how uninteresting they are, right? And this is something I talk about all the time, but college football is one of those sports where historically there's haves and have-nots, right? And it's one thing if you stink. It's another thing if you stink and you're boring, right? Lane Kiffin, you know, maybe he'll go 3-7, 4-8, 4-6 this year, whatever. But he's putting up points. He's having fun. He's throwing his play sheet. He's doing well. You look at Purdue with Jeff Brohm. He hasn't been great, but they're scoring points. It's fun. It's entertaining. It's Purdue. You understand that you're not Ohio State or Michigan or Nebraska or whatever, but if you can put up points, be entertaining, pull off an upset here and there, everybody kind of gets like, this is the ceiling of what we can do. And so with South Carolina, not only are you bad, you're uninteresting. And you don't have a coach that's very likable. And I know the whole deal of, oh, he's a nice guy behind the scenes. Well, if you stink and you're not entertaining, it doesn't matter how nice you are behind the scenes. It matters what happens on the field. And so because of it, I think I would say a couple things. First of all, with Will Muschamp, it's kind of incredible. I'm actually kind of genuinely curious to see what the next chapter of his career is, because it's crazy. I've been doing this so long that this has come full circle, which is when I first started writing about college football in any form or fashion. Will Muschamp was like the hot coaching candidate. He was the defensive coordinator at Texas. Everybody wanted him. He waited. He took his time. He ends up at Florida, and it just doesn't work. I will say, I think that the circumstances that led him to South Carolina were not ideal for him or the school. If you remember, South Carolina, I believe, and I talked to Seth Emerson about this on the podcast a few weeks ago, South Carolina was in position to hire Kirby Smart. They thought they were getting Kirby Smart. Then Georgia fires Mark Richt out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, you're looking around saying like, oh my goodness, the guy that we wanted, and we have nowhere to go, nothing to do. It felt like they froze. It felt like they panicked. And it felt like they forced themselves into Will Muschamp, who, as we all know, I'm not breaking any news here, wasn't very good at Florida either. And for people who don't remember that situation, he took over for Urban Meyer. So took over a program that was in turmoil. There were problems internally. Players were getting away with stuff. But you couldn't argue that the team wasn't successful and that he didn't have a good infrastructure to win games. But I bring all this up just to very simply say that, you know, he didn't work at Florida. And I feel like South Carolina kind of froze when they thought they were going to get Kirby Smart. And then on the opposite side, I think Will Muschamp, I know it's an SEC job. I know you're going to get paid $25 million, and you'll probably never have to work again if you don't want to. But he had only done 1 year following Florida, and it felt like it was maybe the right opportunity for him to sit out, to relax, to work as a defensive coordinator. If memory serves me correct, he was only at Auburn as their defensive coordinator for one season. And I believe Gus Malzahn was kind of mad. He paid him a lot of money to come to South Carolina to be the coordinator. And you wonder if Will Muschamp maybe should have been a little bit taken more time, right? Like I remember even talking about it when that hiring happened. And I didn't have any platform like this on a podcast or anything, but I remember it being like, it just felt rushed, right? It felt rushed from South Carolina's perspective. It felt rushed from Will Muschamp's perspective. And I will say, I'm curious to see what the next chapter is, because I still think he can be a successful defensive coordinator, but he's just not head coaching material. And that's the deal, right? Sometimes in life, you're really good as a number two, you're really good as an assistant, but he wasn't good as a head coach. So now I think the question becomes, what's next for South Carolina? And that's where, to me, it gets really interesting, right? Because I think you can look at this from a number of different perspectives. First of all, I have a buddy named Mark Ryan, who's a radio host down in South Carolina. He wants Brent Venables, who is the Clemson defensive coordinator, as South Carolina's next head coach. And I'll just be honest, I don't see it. Don't know if you've watched Clemson lately, but Brent Venables is a lunatic, defensive-minded, you know, defense-first guy that's kind of crazy. And he's a, I don't know if he's a yeller and a screamer like Will Muschamp, but he's definitely emotional. And the one thing I can tell you about college athletics is that when you fire somebody because they don't work, I can just tell you that in general, and I know this from talking to coaches and ADs in football and basketball, is they oftentimes pursue somebody who's the opposite of the guy that they just fired. Whether it's the best candidate or not, that is often how it ends up happening. You fire an old guy, he's a little old, you know, he's kind of behind the times. You hire the young, brash, ambitious guy. You fire the young, brash, ambitious guy, you go get the old guy. He's been around the block, things are a little bit slower. You have a player's coach, he's a little more lax. You fire him, you bring in the strict disciplinarian and vice versa. That's just how it works. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't think Brent Venables, to me, is the first name that comes to mind. Now, I will say, first name that does come to mind is the guy that I talked about a few episodes ago, which was Hugh Freeze. And so there's a couple variables with Hugh Freeze here, right? First of all, I think on the negative side, one, he just signed an extension with Liberty. I'm not sold that I don't know if he'll be able to get out of that in one season. I don't know if he is in a rush to get back to the SEC. He's got a good deal at Liberty. My understanding is he's one of the highest paid non-Power 5 coaches in college football. And so maybe he sits around, maybe he waits for a better opportunity, or at the very least stays at Liberty a little bit longer. I don't think money is as much of an issue for him. Money's an issue for everybody, but he's made a lot of money. I don't think he's rushing to get back if it's not the right situation. I'll give you an example on this. Steve Sarkisian, the Alabama offensive coordinator, former USC head coach. Steve Sarkisian was offered the Colorado job last year, and he could have taken it, but he said, it doesn't feel right, timing's not right, let me take my time, let me find a better job. Maybe South Carolina is the job, ironically enough, but I think you get to a certain point in your career where sometimes you're not always rushing to the next spot. So with Hugh Freeze, I think there's that variable. He just signed an extension. There is the fact that the SEC, I don't know how to put this delicately, but they really frown upon bringing in guys with previous NCAA rules violations. And while nothing was directly attributed to Hugh Freeze from his time at Ole Miss, as you remember, they had major, major recruiting and rules violations. The Laramie Tunsil gas mask bong. There was texts of somebody paying Laramie Tunsil's bills. And, you know, Greg Sankey has made it a point, like, I don't want these guys coming back into the conference. I think at one point Nick Saban tried to hire Hugh Freeze as either an offensive coordinator or an offensive coach, and the conference kind of balked, right? The conference kind of balked when Lane Kiffin was brought back as an offensive coordinator for Alabama. And I do think there would be some hesitation from the SEC office, although I don't know that they would stand in the way from taking Will Muschamp or taking Hugh Freeze if they believe that he is the best candidate. Those are the negatives of Hugh Freeze. Of course, the positive is the most obvious. The guy wins everywhere. He is a rock star. As I said on the show last week, I believe he's one of the 7 or 8 best coaches in college football. You don't go to Liberty and go 7-0, beat Virginia Tech, beat Syracuse in your second season transitioning from FCS football. Keep in mind, he doesn't even have a full roster of guys recruited to play FBS football, and he's 7-0 going for 8-0 this weekend against North Carolina State. So that's like why you hire Hugh Freeze, because he's awesome and he's really good. I do think there will be some hurdles, and one of the hurdles will be just frankly, does he want the job? In that same vein, I think the guy that makes the most sense to me, the name that I've been hearing, is a guy named Billy Napier, who is the head coach at Louisiana. I will not bore you to tears with his resume, but Louisiana, of course, was the team, if you remember, week one of this season, they upset Iowa State at Iowa State. They went 11-3 last year. He's a young guy. He's an offensive first guy. They had one of the top 10 offenses in college football last season. And as I just said a minute ago, they're 7-0 this year, 7-1 this year, excuse me. Their only loss was to Coastal Carolina, who's a really good team, and they are ranked in the top 25 as I speak here, with Louisiana coming back into the top 25 this week. Some people are pushing for the Coastal Carolina coach. There's other guys in the mix. But to me, listen, I'm not going to lie. I told you on Monday, on last Tuesday's show, if I could go get Hugh Freeze, I'd go get Hugh Freeze because I think he gives them the best chance to win. But I do think the Billy Napier guy would be probably a more logical fit. We will see if he's interested. He's another one like Steve Sarkisian that turned down some opportunities last year. We will see if he has interest. But that is the deal with South Carolina. That is who I believe that they should go after. And all I'll say is it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. I think it goes without saying And South Carolina fired Will Muschamp when they could to go out and get the best candidate that they possibly could and do it before any other job opens up, right? Like at some point, Michigan, which we're going to talk about, Michigan's going to open up. Now, Jim Harbaugh is going to go to the NFL. The school might not owe him any money, but Michigan's going to, like, there's no way Michigan keeps going the way that they're going right now. You know, USC may open up at some point. Obviously, if USC opens up, that means some other good job is going to open up because you're going to have to replace Clay Helton. So does that mean that maybe potentially you're talking about a scenario where James Franklin goes to USC, Penn State then, of course, has an opening. So the point being, South Carolina did this at this time to get ahead of schedule, to get the best candidate possible, and it'll be interesting to see what they did. But listen. I understand it's a pandemic. I understand money is tight, but they had to do what they thought was best for their athletic department, and they did what they did. I get it, and I hope they're more interesting. I hope they go get somebody interesting because the SEC is full of interesting coaches, whether it is Lane Kiffin, Nick Saban, Ed Orgeron, Mike Leach, Dan Mullen, Jimbo Fisher, and now we'll see what South Carolina does. All right, so that's it for the Will Muschamp portion of the show, and I'm not going to waste any more time. I'm going to take a quick break, and then I'm just going to, as I said, I'm just going to roll out the intro the way that it was. It's 2 or 3 minutes of me explaining what the show is, and then we'll get right into the show. I appreciate you guys listening. I appreciate you guys allowing me to do these 15, 20 minutes off the top with Will Muschamp, and now let's get to the rest of today's show. Welcome in, everybody. Episode 319 of the podcast. It is Super America, the Air Tour Sports Podcast. It is Monday, November 16th, 2020, people. I hope everybody is having a great day. I hope everybody is having a great week. And I hope everybody, of course, had a great weekend. Great Monday episode of the Air Tour Sports Podcast coming for you today. And let me tell you this. Little bit of a quiet week in college football. No Alabama, no Ohio State, no Clemson, no Georgia, no Texas A&M, no BYU. A lot of games canceled, postponed, altered, whatever. And so because of it, I do think it'll be a little bit of a shorter Monday edition of the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. These puppies have been running over an hour, and I hope to God, I think I should get you out of here in about 35 to 40 minutes, if not less. Only a few quick topics I do want to hit on today. With so few games, I do want to start to talk about the narrative that kind of formulated late last week with all the cancellations, all the game delays, all that kind of stuff. People are asking, is this a situation where maybe because of all these cancellations, we should be pushing back the end of the season? I'll tell you why that's not feasible. I will tell you why it's not going to happen and why, while it's a good idea in theory, it's simply not going to work. I will then talk about who I believe was the single biggest winner this weekend because with so many games canceled, it did allow certain teams to really kind of have the stage to themselves. I don't believe that there was a bigger winner than Florida. Unfortunately, I don't believe that there was a bigger loser than Michigan, and I know we talk about Michigan every week, and I apologize that this is turning into Wolverine talk with Torres, but I think this was the week that everybody really saw what I've been telling you for 2 or 3 weeks now, that this program is headed in the wrong direction in a hurry, and it's going to be a disaster. We will just get into what's next for Harbaugh. How did it get so bad so fast? Because I think it's an incredible conversation to have. And we'll wrap on kind of a positive note because as I was watching Kyle Trask on Saturday night at Florida, I started to realize I believe this may go down as the best Heisman race of my lifetime. So we will talk about Kyle Trask and the Heisman Trophy as so many good candidates for that award. Also, one quick scheduling note, Tuesday's show. People have forgotten, but the NBA draft of all events is actually on Wednesday. And so Tuesday's show, barring some crazy shocking news, Nick Saban tests positive for COVID again. If it is anything crazy, Tuesday's episode will be a full NBA draft preview. And what I'll do is I will bring back a lot of the interviews that I did with NBA draft prospects in the springtime. That many of you may have missed. You know, you're either new to the show or were in the middle of a pandemic. You weren't listening to podcasts. You were working from home. I'm going to bring back interviews with Obi Toppin, Emmanuel Quickley, the SEC Player of the Year, Mason Jones from Arkansas, and it'll be a really fun show on Tuesday. That's Tuesday's show. Thursday may have a really big guest, so stay tuned for that. But Monday's show, college football. Tuesday's show, NBA draft. And let's get into Monday's show. Before we do, I want to remind you, please make sure that you are subscribed to the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. You can do it on iTunes, the Podcast Addict app. If you have an Android, the Podcast Addict app is the way to go. Podbean, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure that you are subscribed to the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. Make sure to rate and review the show. Go ahead, give us a quick 5 stars. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, all those good things. Make sure you're following on social media at Aaron_Torres on Twitter, at Aaron Torres Pod on Instagram. And one little quick scheduling note as well. I have gone ahead. Many of you have asked me in the past, is there any one place that I can go and get all your stuff at once, all your writing, all your podcasts, everything that you're doing? The answer has essentially been no, but I have started an email list where you can have all the links to all the podcasts and everything sent straight to your email on Fridays. That would be if you go to my Twitter page, at Aaron_Torres, you can sign up right there. But many of you have asked, so I wanted to make sure to do that. And so if you want to get all your stuff sent to you, go to my Twitter page, at Aaron_Torres, and it is right there. And with that said, people, there is no more time to waste. Let's get into it. Because as I said, kind of surreal what the college football world has come to really the last week or so, right? I mean, it all started Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You start to see some of these SEC games get canceled. Auburn, Mississippi State, Georgia, Missouri, Texas A&M, Tennessee, Alabama, LSU was obviously the big one. And then as time goes on, crazier stuff happens, right? So most notably, the UCLA Cal game gets put together on one day's notice, and those two teams played Sunday at the Rose Bowl. It was kind of incredible. For people who did not follow this story, Cal was supposed to play Arizona State. Arizona State had an outbreak of positive COVID tests. UCLA was supposed to play Utah. Utah had an outbreak of positive COVID tests. And so the Pac-12 basically got everybody together and said, you know what? You guys can play. Let's get the two of you together. And that game was basically put together on one day's notice. And so when you factor that in with what happened across the SEC, across the Big Ten, where Ohio State, Maryland got canceled, it led the people that have never wanted college football to begin with to get back on their high horse and now talk about what a farce this season is, right? We have all these games canceled. It's clear that many of them will not be able to be made up. You now have teams putting together a game on one day's notice. Cal and UCLA aren't even on the schedule. They go from not playing to playing on Sunday morning. And I kind of got the sense that it was a kind of a turning point and an inflection moment in the college football season. Many people are wondering, is this just too absurd? Are we going too far above and beyond? But then also a second conversation, which I thought was actually very interesting, which is it time to consider moving back the college football season, giving it more time, letting it breathe, adding a couple extra weeks, moving back the college football playoff, moving back the national championship, because we're just trying to squeeze too much into too small of a space. And I will say, when it comes to that, I do understand kind of the conversation and the narrative, because this is a year where every sport has dealt with unprecedented stuff and where everything is getting moved and adjusted on the fly, right? The NBA season was canceled, season was postponed, gets moved to a bubble, obviously unprecedented circumstances. Same with the NHL, same with Major League Baseball. Major League Baseball playing a World Series in a bubble. College basketball season has been moved back 2 or 3 weeks. So the idea of moving back the college football season, add a couple extra weeks to the regular season, move the college football playoff back, to a lot of people, it does make sense. I'm here to tell you, it ain't going to happen. And let's get into why. And before we do, I do kind of want to backtrack and talk a little bit about this narrative of, you know, this season's a farce, all that stuff. First of all, like I said, every sport is doing the best that they can to just get a season in, get it done, get games on the record that count, right? I feel like college football, for whatever reason, is always an inflection point. Everyone is always critical. Everybody says college football is trying too hard. But to me, the fact that we're trying to squeeze in all these games is no different than the NBA picking up their operations and moving it down to Orlando for the bubble. It's not ideal, but it's part of the situation. It's part of the circumstances that happen. I would go so far as to say, in addition to that, I don't really feel bad for the players or teams that are now having their schedules altered, changed, rearranged, whatever, and you have a situation where Cal and UCLA are playing on one day's notice. I understand it's not ideal. I don't want to be unsympathetic to the players. But listen, two things. One, I've been saying, we've all been saying since this pandemic started in March, that guess what? When sports come back, it's going to look different. It's going to be unprecedented, and this is just part of the deal. I see all these people freaking out because 15 college football games were postponed on Saturday, when the reality is, instead, let's celebrate the games that get played. Coming into this weekend, 85% of college football games that were scheduled have been played. And so you can criticize college football and, oh my God, it's so dangerous. 85%. If I had told you in August that 85% of games would be played, we would have been over the roof, over the moon, excuse me. We would have been thrilled if 85% of the games got played. And as far as the players, as far as it being unfair, I'll tell you this, I'm not trying to be unsympathetic to the players. But guess what? Life isn't fair sometimes. And these are players that advocated for themselves, especially in the Pac-12, especially in the Big Ten, and really across the country, that they wanted to play. They wanted to play games this season, okay? And so I don't want to, again, for the thousandth time, be unsympathetic to them. But when you fight for a season, when you say you'll play anytime, anywhere, whatever the circumstances, well, sometimes you're going to have to play an opponent on a short week. Your schedule is going to have to get changed. You're going to have to play a day early. You're going to have to play a day late. You're going to have to kick off on a Sunday going head-to-head with NFL. That's just part of the deal. Now, in terms of the conversation about pushing back the college football playoff, again, I get it, right? We're in a situation where I'm recording here on Sunday in November. I just watched the Masters. The Masters got moved. The NBA playoffs were in the fall. Major League Baseball season didn't start until July. And so I understand this conversation of let's just push back the college football season. Why are we trying to squeeze in all these games in a finite window? Let's just give it a couple more weeks. Let's just give it time. Let's let everybody get in more games, and let's have more of a balanced playing field. First of all, what I would say is, just because you move back the season, you add weeks to the schedule, doesn't mean these games are going to definitively get played. As I said last week, I'm not going to get into it. I'm not going to spend too much time. But the reality is, it's November. It's cold and flu season. People are going to get sick. So the idea that we just add weeks to the schedule sounds great in theory, but in reality, I don't know that that definitively means that more games are getting in. I would add on top of that, when exactly do you want to play these games? And to me, this is probably the biggest reason why college football will not reschedule, will not start over, will not change the schedule the way that it is. And it's because it sounds great in theory. It sounds wonderful to go ahead and push the college football season back 2, 3, 4 weeks. Maybe you finish the regular season around January 1st. You play the playoff games the 10th. You play the championship game the 17th. There's just one problem. There's other sports going on. And while the NBA and the Masters and Major League Baseball, they had no control over the fact that if they wanted to come back, they had to go head-to-head with the NFL, college football does. And college football does not want to go head-to-head with the NFL. And if you look at the calendar, if you don't play those college football playoff games, if you don't play those college football playoff games on January 1st as scheduled, chances are pretty good that they are not going to happen. And what do I mean by that? Well, if you just have a basic understanding of the sports calendar, I take that back. I don't want to say they won't happen. What I want to say is they will get crushed by the NFL. Because the way the schedule breaks, things work out perfectly for college football. January 1st this year is on a Friday. So you get those two college football playoff games in on the 1st. You play the national championship game, not the following Monday, but the Monday after, which would be the 10th. And you get the season over. End of story, crown a champion, whatever, right? If you start pushing back the season, here's the problem. Again, if you have any understanding of how the sports calendar works, not sure if you heard, but the NFL starts their playoffs the following weekend on Saturday, January 9th. And if you remember, the NFL playoff structure is that on wild card weekend, you get two games on Saturday, two games on Sunday. Then the following weekend on the divisional round, you get two games on Saturday, two games on Sunday. I would add this. Remember, The NFL is adding a seventh playoff team to the schedule this year, which means that now on that wild card weekend, we get three games on Saturday and three games on Sunday. And so you're talking about if you don't play the games as scheduled on that Saturday, or excuse me, on January 1st, if you try to push back 2 weeks, now you're going head-to-head with the NFL, and there's no window for you to play. The NFL's playing all day Saturday on the second and third Saturdays of January. You can't play on Sunday because that's the NFL's time. And what are you going to do, play during the middle of the week? Sounds preposterous. Not to mention that, oh, by the way, college basketball will be under full swing at that point, and the NBA returns December 22nd. And so if we're talking about pushing back the season, you're now going head-to-head with the NBA, college basketball, the NFL, and you're going to have no windows to do it, right? Can't do it on Saturday, can't do it on Sunday. What are you going to do, play Friday and Thursday and Wednesday? Doesn't make sense. And so the idea that college football is going to expand their season, it's just not going to happen. I would add another reason, which people are not talking about, which I think is just important, and that's like the players themselves. Like, I think it's easy for us to see, like it's very weird to me, right? There are times where it's all about the players and player safety and mental health and this and that. And then there's other times where it's just like, yeah, screw it, but it's really about entertainment. And so I think this is actually a perfect example of that, right? So, like, we talk about, like, player health and player safety and mental health and all that stuff. You understand that most of these guys have been on campus since July, right? They've been working out. They've been practicing. They've been playing. Their season started. Their season stopped. And now you're going to ask them to keep going another 2, 3, 4 weeks? On top of that, not only asking them to go another 2, 3, 4 weeks, but you're going to now ask them to go through the Christmas and January 1st New Year's holiday. Now, I understand there's some weird bowl games and there's some teams that might have to stay on campus through Christmas anyway. But I'm just saying, you've asked these kids to do so much. Many of them have not gone home to see their parents. I can't tell you how many coaches I've talked to over the last couple of months that have basically been like, dude, even on our bye weeks, we're telling the guys, don't go home unless you have to. If you're going to go home, be responsible. Don't be around large groups of people. Stay a distance. You know, be responsible. Be smart. Be safe. These kids have been doing everything that's been asked of them since July. They haven't gotten traditional bye weeks. They haven't gotten traditional time off. They haven't even gotten, in many cases, to see their parents after their games, if the parents can even attend the games in person. And so when I look at this situation with college football, you're now asking these players that have been there since July with basically no break. Now you're asking them, it's one thing to ask them to go through December 5th, which is normally the end of the regular season, and now we're asking them to play straight through the middle of December. But to ask them to play through Christmas and New Year's, that just feels like a lot, man. That just feels like a lot. And I think it's going to be tough enough to keep these players focused as is. This has become a very interesting talking point in college football, but I think there's kind of a growing concern about being able to finish this season from the perspectives of the bad teams doing what they're supposed to do to keep the season going. What I mean by that is take Michigan, take Penn State. You know, Penn State started this season, I don't know if they really had playoff aspirations or whatever. They're now 0-4. They have nothing to play for other than pride. And to ask 85 guys to do what they've been doing, to isolate, to not go out, to not have fun, to not party, it's easy to do it when you're 0-0 and you think, well, we got Ohio State week 2. We win that game. We're going to compete for a national championship. Well, now they're 0-4. How inspired are they to keep kind of the straight ahead blinders on? How about Mississippi State, Tennessee, Missouri, South Carolina, Nebraska, Michigan, like there's so many teams that I just think most coaches just want to get to the finish line. And so the idea of pushing back the weeks, the idea of adding games to the schedule, when we already kind of know who the best teams are, like it just doesn't make any sense. And so when I think about it in the big picture, I don't really understand why people are advocating for this, right? Every time we get a canceled game, you see the same 5 media members. Oh my God, that's 11 canceled games. But we should also push the season back and expand the playoff. Well, you can't have both. If you're worried about every canceled game, why are we adding weeks to the schedule, games to the schedule, keeping these kids on campus longer, asking them to be responsible longer? It makes no sense. It makes no sense. And so to me, I think it's a great narrative. But I think in reality, I hate to say it, we just got to get to the finish line. And I love college football. Selfishly, I wish the college football season went on forever. But I understand these are human beings. I understand these are kids that, again, in the Big 12, in the SEC, in the ACC, they've been asked to stick around campus and basically be on their best behavior since July, since June, since early August, with no bye weeks, don't go home, not socializing with your normal student body, getting tested every day. At some point, we got to just get the season in and get on and move on to the next thing. And so to me, I think it's a great story. Like I said, I don't think that it necessarily makes sense to continue this conversation that we're going to push on the season. I just don't think it makes any sense. All right, let's transition to what, as I said off the top of the show, is in my opinion probably the single biggest winner of the college football weekend. And that's the University of Florida, because when you look at the situation across college football, as I mentioned, quiet week, Clemson's gonna bye, Ohio State, Alabama, Texas A&M, Georgia, their games get canceled. And so it gave a nice showcase for a lot of different teams, right? Great weekend for Indiana. They beat Michigan State. Everyone's like, oh my goodness, this team might actually be pretty good. Great weekend for Notre Dame, by the way, who I thought in reality might have a step back game, might have a letdown game, I guess would be the right way to put it. Weren't going to be up for playing at Boston College after they beat Clemson. They largely dominated that game. But I felt like there wasn't a single bigger winner on Saturday than the University of Florida. Because the University of Florida, I think they've been kind of dancing around the conversation of, are they a college football playoff contender? Are they not? What's the deal? What's the scoop? And they play Arkansas at home, and they completely dominate Arkansas. One of the best performances that we've seen from a team, one of the best performances that we've seen from a player in Kyle Trask, and get a very convincing 63-35 win. And I think in doing that, Florida established itself as one team. They are now the proverbial team that nobody wants to see going forward, right? And that's not a knock on the other elite teams, right? That's not a knock on Clemson or Alabama. It's not saying any people are like lined up, excited to play Alabama. But I think when I look at Florida, they were a team that was kind of on the fringes of, well, if everything breaks right and who knows and what's going to happen and if this goes right and that goes right and there's this tiebreaker and maybe they'll be in the conversation. They lose to Texas A&M. We kind of forget about them. But the last 2 weeks, I feel like they have put their foot down. And they said, wait a second now. You already got Clemson, Ohio State, and Alabama in the conversation. We added Notre Dame after they beat Clemson. Don't forget about us now. Oh, by the way, you added A&M who beat us. But don't forget about us, because we are here. We are ready to compete, and we are ready to play, and we are ready to challenge for one of those four playoff spots in the college football playoff. Not saying they'll get there, but I think they threw their hat in the ring of saying, if you're not including us in this conversation, you better make sure to do so. And if you watch Saturday's game, it was just a masterclass. It really was. And for Florida, I think they had a lot of the same questions coming in that, frankly, I had about Notre Dame, right? Notre Dame gets this incredible emotional win against Clemson last week. Are they going to come out flat against Boston College? The same with Florida. You play your biggest rival. It's a team that's had your number. Kirby Smart was 3-0 coming into this game last week against Florida in his time at Georgia, which means that basically there's nobody really on the roster that's ever beaten Georgia in a rivalry game. You smoke them. And then you come out and you play a really good Arkansas team, and I thought Florida was going to come out flat. Instead, jump out from the gun, completely dominate. It's 35-14 at halftime. You look at later in the game, it's 56-21 at some point, and so don't let the 63-28 final score fool you. 63-35 final score fool you. Florida completely dominated this game, and it was against a really good Arkansas team, which was 3-3 coming into this game, 4-2 overall. Let me backtrack. Arkansas was 3-3. They should have been 4-2 because they should have beaten Auburn. And they were 6-0 against the spread, which means that they have played games closer all season long than Vegas had anticipated that they would. And so when you look at this domination by Florida and you look at what they did last week against Georgia, I just think they're in that conversation of team nobody wants to see. It starts on the offense where Kyle Trask is just, look, I mean, I'm not the first person to say this. I'm not claiming it's an original thought. But if you don't have Kyle Trask at the front of your Heisman conversation, you're not watching college football, right? 6 touchdown passes on Saturday night against Arkansas, 5 in the first half, and on the season, how about this for a stat line? 70% completion percentage, 2,100 yards passing, 28 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. And it's not as though he hasn't played good teams. Texas A&M, really, really good. Georgia, we thought was one of the best defenses in college football, and Kyle Trask sliced him and diced him. And again, you get an Arkansas team on Saturday that was playing really good overall. I know Sam Pittman wasn't in the building. I know he was at home with COVID, but it doesn't change the fact that Florida beat a really good team on Saturday night in the Swamp. And so when I look at it in the bigger picture, it goes back to what I just said a second ago. I think they are now absolutely in the conversation. Because, you know, you think back to earlier in the season, right? First couple games, oh, they got this great offense, but can they stop anybody? Ole Miss is able to move the ball against them. South Carolina is able to move the ball against them. And then you play Texas A&M. You lose to Texas A&M. You have the COVID outbreak. And you kind of think like, wait a second now. This is just like a fun offense. Like, they're kind of quirky. Dan Mullen's kind of saying some stuff. He's wearing the Darth Vader mask. But the last 3 weeks since they came back from COVID, beat Missouri 41-17. And as somebody who watched that game, it wasn't even that close. Missouri scored a bunch of points late to make it seem even closer than the 24-point final score indicated. Then you go play Georgia last week, and that was when I really started to think, wait a second now, Florida's right here in this conversation. Because they fall down 14-0 to Georgia, and you think, here we go again. Georgia's beat up. They're down a bunch of guys. Their best cornerback got in a bike accident. And they're still beating Florida. And then Florida rips off before halftime, 38 points. They take a 38-21 lead into halftime and never look back. And that's when I sat there and said, wait a second now. Maybe their defense ain't the 85 Bears, but when you can score at the level that they can score at, you can compete with anybody. That's exactly what happens. And then to go on at home and beat Arkansas the way that they did was just really, really impressive to me. And so I think when you think about playoff teams, I think it's what I said a minute ago. We all kind of have Alabama in one of those spots. We all kind of have Ohio State in one of those spots. And I think we kind of understand, like, Notre Dame beat Clemson. But Clemson's going to get Trevor Lawrence back. They'll probably beat Notre Dame. And they'll split their two games. And those are probably the four teams. And if you want to start talking about other teams that are on the fringes, you probably got to start with Texas A&M, which actually did beat Florida, to their credit. So to the A&M fans, get off my back. I'm not saying that your win doesn't mean anything. I'm just saying that A&M was kind of that other team that was in the conversation. You know, there's a little Cincinnati buzz, a little BYU buzz. Wisconsin dominates Michigan, which we'll get into in a second. And I just look at Florida and I say, man, that is the team that I do not want to play. Because the offense is so explosive, veteran quarterback, confident in what they do. The run game is getting going. They actually ran the ball really well against Arkansas on Saturday night. And I think the defense is coming around. Like I said, I think it's hard to sit here and say, well, they gave up 35 points to Arkansas. Yeah, but if you watch the game, Arkansas had basically 21 points through 3.5 quarters. They put up 2 touchdowns late. And so I think when you factor in all those things, this is a team that seems to be getting better every week. And I think in the broader perspective is a team that can challenge and play with just about everybody in college football, right? Like, I think we all have Alabama just penciled in as the SEC champ. I'll tell you this, Florida feels like the one team that can go score for score with Alabama and keep it competitive. Do I think they can definitively win? I'm not saying they can definitively win. I do think Alabama has certain advantages. I think they run the ball better with Najee Harris. I think not having Jalen Waddle will eventually catch up with them, their best wide receiver. The defense has been hot and cold, but playing better. But I think if you gave Nick Saban some truth serum, I don't even think it's a debate. I think he knows how tough Florida is and how tough they could create a challenge for him. And I think when you look at it, again, in the bigger picture of even that, you don't think Florida could step on the field with Clemson and compete? Like, no disrespect to Clemson. I know they didn't have Trevor Lawrence. They got pushed around at the line of scrimmage. They're not this physically dominating team that they have been in years past on both lines of scrimmage. Notre Dame actually dominated them largely up front. You go beyond that, Ohio State. I think Ohio State has been in certain areas not as strong as their team and coach and program and fans expected them to be. So all I'm saying is, I'm not saying Florida's going to make the playoff. I'm not saying they're unbelievable, they're unstoppable. I'm just saying, like, if you look at Florida, you look at what they've done, you look at who they've beaten and how they've beaten them, I think they are the team that is trending in the right direction. And like I said, they are the team that nobody is going to want to play down the stretch. If they they're going to make the SEC championship game. I think they can give Alabama a tough game. And who knows from there? Maybe they beat Alabama, win the SEC, and who's to say? But the broader point is, I think they are as tough, if not tougher, than people are giving them credit for. You know who's not very tough? The Michigan Wolverines, man. Listen, I swear, guys, I apologize. I know every week I say I'm not going to talk about them again next week. And then every week it is a new low. And I will say, credit to you guys, because if you've listened to this show, I think I kind of prepped you for what was going to happen on Saturday night, right? And I get it, right? A lot of people, whether you're just a fan, whether other media members, maybe you're covering a team, maybe you go to your team's games, you don't have time to sit in front of a TV and watch games all day like I do. That's why I do this podcast. That's my job, right? Sit in front of the TV, watch, react. And I was very praising of Michigan after the win against Minnesota. As it turns out, Minnesota isn't very good. I think you started to see the warts and the problems in the Michigan State game. And then I told you this last week. I said after the Indiana game, I said it's done. I said they're not good. They're not an elite team. And I don't know what Michigan does at an elite level in college football right now. Quarterback is not very accurate, as you saw Saturday against Wisconsin when he threw it to the other team with nobody within 20 yards. Offensive line cannot block. They're about as bad as I have ever seen them in terms of blocking, certainly at least under Jim Harbaugh. Receivers can't catch. Defensive line's getting blown off the ball. The corners and safeties, who have usually been really good in coverage, can't guard anybody in coverage. And they basically got one guy on defense who makes all the plays, named Dax Hill. And so I told you after the Indiana game, I said, this is going the wrong way in a hurry. And everybody said, oh, you know, whatever. And like, I don't know if it's just because there was a million other games going on, people aren't really paying attention. But it felt like Saturday was the day where everybody realized, wow, this thing has gotten way worse, way faster than I could have ever imagined. And you saw people that don't normally commentate on Jim Harbaugh just saying, like, it's over, man. Like, it is really definitively 100% over. And where do we go from here? And look, I've done the where do we go from here conversation. I'm not going to get into it. But when you watch a Wisconsin team that had 2 weeks off from contact practices physically dominate Michigan, you just realize that this thing is going off the rails faster than you ever could have imagined. And this is where we are. This is where we are, where I talked about last week, where Jim Harbaugh has 1 year left on his contract. You can't extend him long term, but you can't bring him back on a one-year contract because you're not going to be able to recruit this year or next year knowing that he's a lame duck. And so it feels like it's inevitable that he's going to be leaving. I think Michigan fans listening are like, he better be leaving. Feels like it's inevitable that he's going to be leaving. But I do think like there's just like it's almost like I'm going to give the Jim Harbaugh obituary right now because it's inevitable. And I've talked about what's wrong, why it's wrong, how it's wrong, what's going to happen next. But like today just feels like a day of mourning. Like there is not a single person on the planet, including Jim Harbaugh himself, that could say this thing is going in the right way. This thing is going to get fixed. And so to me, the question becomes, how did it get so bad so fast? And I do think it is like a very fascinating question, right? And I do think in a lot of ways it's sad because think about it from the most basic level. This is a guy who 6 years ago got his dream job, alma mater, returns to Michigan. His father was an assistant coach there. His dad now lives right next door to him, raising his own kids in the community. Going to raise them back, going to bring them back to that national championship level. Dream job. And I know that he's done some things that rub people the wrong way, and he's been a little too brash and outspoken. But at the end of the day, imagine getting your dream job. Imagine getting the team that you're coaching to the brink of what you thought you would. And he did get them there, which we'll get into in a minute. And then it completely crashing and burning, and you realizing that you are not who you thought you were as a coach, and you are not going to get your school to the place that you thought you would be able to. and that your dream job has now turned into a nightmare. And to Jim Harbaugh's credit, as I always say, he was really close to getting Michigan to that upper level. Year two, I always say it, bad spot at Ohio State. They could have won the game in regulation. If they win that game, they go to the Big Ten championship. They probably make the college football playoff. And Jim Harbaugh forever at least has that one win against Ohio State. He probably has a playoff berth. And as bad as it is now, he can always hold on to that forever and say, look, I kind of did what I was brought here to do. I beat Ohio State, all that stuff. Instead, it's not going to happen. And I do just think about it from the broader perspective of, like I said a minute ago, how did it get so bad so fast? Because when you think about it at its most basic level, it is really kind of incredible, right? I mean, like, there's a like for all the criticism that Jim Harbaugh gets, like, there was a reason that everybody thought that this was a home run hire, that it was going to work, and that he was going to elevate Michigan. And those reasons are what you know. But when you still think about it, it's kind of crazy, right? This guy won at every level of football that you can possibly win at. Great player in college, great player in the NFL. As a head coach, won at the D2 level, won at Stanford. It's easy to look at Stanford now and say, well, you know, I mean, a lot of people could win Stanford. No, they couldn't. Go back to look at what Stanford was up until he got that job in the early 2000s. They were one of the worst Power 5 football teams in America. They were basically the equivalent of what Vanderbilt is right now. So take what Vanderbilt is right now, bring in Jim Harbaugh, and within a couple years, he has him in the Orange Bowl. He has him at 10-11 wins. And he, of course, goes off to the NFL where, again, he's a player too from winning the Super Bowl. And so I think when you think about it from that level, it really is kind of crazy, right? This guy won at D2. He won at one of the toughest jobs in college football. He won in the NFL. Michigan was the one place where it shouldn't have even been a debate. Because you look at Michigan, you look how they're set up. You look at how good the school is. You look at the resources. You look at the history. Outside of Ohio State and Penn State, I mean, you're lined up to win 10 games every year without even blinking. And that's certainly what he did, and that's certainly what happened early, but it hasn't been sustainable. And so, as I said a minute ago, you know, one thing I always try to do on this show, I always try to talk about the why. I always try to break down, okay, here's the problem, this is why it happened, or here's the problem, here's the solution, or this is a good thing, and this is why it's good, and this is how it happened. And with Harbaugh, I don't think there's an easy answer as to why this thing has fallen so far so fast. And I think if you ask people across college football, they can't tell you how it's fallen so far so fast. I mean, never forget, 2 years ago, not last season, but the season before, Michigan was 10-1 going into the Ohio State game. It was Urban Meyer's last regular season game at Ohio State. He, of course, won the Big Ten and went to the Rose Bowl. But Michigan was 10-1 going into that game. Like, it's not as though he went from 10 wins to 7 to 5 to 3. 18 months ago, like 24 months ago, 10-1 going into that Ohio State game. And so when you think about what went wrong, I really only have one real thought on that. And that's this. I do wonder if Michigan's obsession, and for Michigan fans listening, I'm not saying obsession in a bad way. You have every right to expect to beat Ohio State, expect to compete with Ohio State, right? Like, that's what Michigan football is on earth to do. That's why you pay Jim Harbaugh $8 million a year to compete with Ohio State. So I'm not saying you're critical. I'm not being critical for wanting this internal desire to beat Ohio State. But what I will say is this. What I will say is I do wonder if their obsession with beating Ohio State has now cost them against everybody else. And what I mean by that is this. I want to go through kind of the history of the Jim Harbaugh era. And I've mentioned it a few times the last few weeks. But first year, 10-3, loses to Ohio State. Second year, 10-3, loses to Ohio State. They were 10-1 coming into that game. That was the game where there was a bad spot. They win that game. They go to the Big Ten championship game. Year three, they lose a bunch of guys. They go 8-5. And then year four was the one I just mentioned. 10-3. But going into that Ohio State game, they were 10-1. They lose to Ohio State. They then lose to Florida in the Peach Bowl. But before that game, before the Ohio State game, which was Urban Meyer's last game, when they went in 10-1, you know, Michigan was kind of what they were, right? Old school Big Ten, smash mouth, 3 yards in a cloud of dust. They played that old school Big Ten boring style. But what happened was, after they lost to Ohio State that year, in year four of the Harbaugh era, this is now year six, in year four, the powers that be at Michigan, whether it be the AD, whether it be the boosters, whoever, they basically said, like, look, we can't be running this archaic offense. We will never beat Ohio State. We will never compete at the highest level. Well, one, I disagree. Maybe you'll never beat Ohio State, but you were competing at the highest level. You were in the top 10. You were as good as any program in the country, not named Ohio State, Clemson, or Alabama. And I know it's easy now with revisionist history to say, oh, well, Wisconsin has been better since Jim Harbaugh got there, and Penn State has been better than since Jim Harbaugh got there. And maybe that's true and maybe it isn't. But what I can tell you is this. How about this? Year four, Jim Harbaugh at Michigan, okay? As I said, they went 10-3, 10-1 going into the Big Ten championship game. That year, they played Penn State. They beat Penn State 42-7. They played Wisconsin. They beat Wisconsin 38-13. So don't tell me that the whole time Michigan's been a middle-of-the-pack team, because as recently as 2 years ago, they were not. But after they lost to Ohio State, basically Jim Harbaugh was told, dude, you can't be running this ancient, archaic, old-school, 3 yards in a cloud of dust BS offense. Go get modern, do this RPO stuff that everybody's doing. Even Nick Saban's on board. It's what Urban Meyer's doing. It's what Oklahoma's doing. It's what all these schools are doing. We need you to be more modern on offense. And Jim Harbaugh famously went out, and he got the coordinator that he has now named Josh Gattis. And when I say famously, it was because I don't know that Jim Harbaugh ever wanted to hire him. And maybe that's wrong. Maybe that's not fair. But, I mean, if you go back and look at it, like, the story is that he never even interviewed Josh Gattis. He called him up on the phone and offered him the job, sight unseen, interview unseen, all that stuff. And so as I look back, I do wonder, did Harbaugh really want to commit to this? Or was he forced to do it? And because he was forced to do it, this team has never been the same. Never forget, again, 2 years ago, 10-3. Last year they go 9-4, but they get smoked by Wisconsin. And for the first half of the season, the offense really struggled. Barely beat Iowa, barely beat Army, get hot at the end of the year, get smoked by Ohio State, get smoked by Alabama, which leads us into this year where they can't beat anybody. And it feels like in the process of trying so hard to modernize their offense, they just don't have an identity anymore, right? Like the old identity, as I've said a few times the last few weeks, at the very least, at least they were dominant up front. Dominant in the trenches. Maybe it was boring. Maybe it was old school. Maybe they didn't have a quarterback like Kyle Trask or Mac Jones or Trevor Lawrence or Justin Fields. But at least they did one thing well. At least they ran the ball well. At least they played great defense. Now, they're trying to do this modern stuff, but they don't really believe in it. And part of it's maybe Jim Harbaugh. Maybe he doesn't trust the coordinator. But whatever the case, they don't know what they're doing on offense. The O-line can't block. The receivers aren't comfortable. The running backs aren't comfortable. The quarterback's not comfortable. And then defensively, they've just fallen apart like a house of cards. And again, to be abundantly clear, I'm not saying that none of this is on Jim Harbaugh, right? Every other coach that's been successful has evolved. Nick Saban famously handed Lane Kiffin the keys to the offense. He said, I trust you to figure this thing out. And it worked. Ed Orgeron, Joe Brady, here's the keys to the offense. Make this thing work. It did. LSU won a national championship. Jim Harbaugh did that with Josh Gattis. Who knows if he really trusts him? Who knows if it's because Jim Harbaugh refuses to evolve? But the bottom line remains this, is that, look, there's no returning at this point, but up until 2 or 3 weeks ago, the old argument could be, well, at least they beat the bad teams. And I do wonder if they had just stuck with what they were doing. Maybe I'm wrong. And there's going to be Michigan fans that get mad at me and comment and tweet at me and all this stuff. Well, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm just saying. I do wonder if, had Jim Harbaugh just stuck with what he was doing, be stubborn, stick with what you're comfortable with, if they at the very least could have remained on that 9-10 win trajectory, not beat Ohio State, but at least dominate everybody else and continue to win. Because you look at what Wisconsin did on Saturday night, and I just think Wisconsin, they're not as athletically gifted. The recruiting rankings aren't as good, but they know who they are. They recruit to a system. They do what they do well. They don't try to be outside of what they're capable of doing. That looked like the football team with the $8 million coach. Not Michigan, but I do feel bad for Harbaugh. I know most people don't, but it's like, to me, I just sit there and say, dude, you got your dream job, and you're crashing and burning in front of the world, and I do feel bad for the guy. All right, before I get out of here, last little topic, and it kind of goes back to the Kyle Trask stuff that I was talking about a minute ago, but you know, as I was kind of just thinking about college football this year, I'll tell you this, is I think that we are in the midst of maybe the best Heisman race of my lifetime. Like, it sounds kind of crazy, right? But if you kind of go through the Heisman year by year by year, it feels like most years you kind of have an idea at this point of, if not who's going to win it, at the very least, like, who's, like, the final two or three, right? Like, last year, Joe Burrow, once he beats Alabama, like, he's going to win the Heisman. Like, so, first week of November, like, everyone else is playing for second place. The year Kyler Murray won it, it was Tua most of the year. It was down to Tua. Kyler comes in late, but it's kind of that two-guy race. There's nobody really behind him. And then you have other years where, whether it was, you know, Marcus Mariota, Johnny Manziel, RG3, you just have a guy that's so much better that you know from the beginning, you know from the middle of the season that they're going to win. And so I was thinking about it this year as it pertains to really, I was thinking about it with Kyle Trask, but in the broader picture of, like, man, we got a really good Heisman candidate pool this year. And I was thinking about it because every team at the top seemingly has an NFL-ready quarterback. And I was just looking at the stats, and I do think it's like if you're not paying attention, the quarterback play in college football this year has been incredible, okay? What I'm just going to do is read you the stats of the best quarterbacks in college football. Kyle Trask completing 70% of his passes, 2,100 yards, 28 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. Mac Jones, how about this for Mac Jones? 78% completion percentage, 12 yards per reception on average, 16 touchdowns, and that's without Jalen Waddle. Trevor Lawrence, who missed two games, 1,800 yards, 17 TDs, 2 interceptions, 71 yards, 71%. Zach Wilson from BYU, 75% completion percentage, 2,500 yards, 22 TDs, 2 interceptions. And Justin Fields has only played 3 games already, 11 touchdowns, 86% completion percentage. Like, guys, I remember a time not too long ago, if a quarterback completed like 67, 68% of his passes, that guy was incredible. Now you have Justin Fields, I know it's only through 3 games, 86% completion. Trevor Lawrence, 71%. Kyle Trask, 70%. Zach Wilson, 75%. Mac Jones, 78%. And it's not as though they're going against bad defenses. It's not as though they're going, they're making easy short throws. I mean, Kyle Trask is throwing the ball all over the field. Same with Zach Wilson. Same with Mac Jones. It is incredible. And so I'm really excited. One, I have no idea who's going to win the Heisman. Is Justin Fields going to get in enough games? Is Trevor Lawrence going to get in enough games? What happens if Mac Jones and Kyle Trask go head-to-head? Zach Wilson, I don't think he'll win it, but I hope that we at least acknowledge him. But I do think it speaks to something else beyond the Heisman being an incredible kind of follow this year, is that I do think beyond that, I think it proves something that I've been saying for a while, and I don't know if I've ever said it on this podcast. I've said it a lot. I've said it a lot in, radio interviews and things like that, but college football, I believe, is increasingly becoming a quarterback-driven sport, right? And like we talk about the NFL, it's like the NFL's quarter. If you don't have Aaron Rodgers or you don't have Patrick Mahomes or you don't have Lamar Jackson or Russell Wilson, you can't win it all. And I've talked about it with Georgia, so I guess I have talked about it on this show. But I think increasingly we're seeing, like, if you don't have that dude at quarterback in college, you can't win either. Think about last year. Think about the playoff. You had Joe Burrow, eventual first number one overall draft pick. Trevor Lawrence is going to be the number one pick in this year's draft, last year's playoff. Justin Fields might be the number two overall pick, would be the number one overall pick in a lot of seasons. Year before, Alabama beats Clemson. Trevor Lawrence versus Tua. Oklahoma makes the playoff with Kyler Murray, number one overall pick. And I just think now, if you look at the sport of college football, if you don't have that guy at quarterback, you just can't do it. Look at the top of the sport right now. Number one, Alabama, Mac Jones. I don't know how he transitions as an NFL guy, but man, is he getting it done at the college level. Clemson, obviously, with Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields at Ohio State. But then, you know, I mentioned Kyle Trask at Florida. Texas A&M, I don't think Kellen Mond is a Heisman candidate, But, I mean, he's having by far his best season as a college quarterback. 16 touchdowns, 2 interceptions, and he looks like a completely different player the last few weeks. And as I mentioned, BYU's ranked really high with Zach Wilson. And then you go to the flip side. Who were some of the more disappointing teams in college football? Michigan can't figure out their quarterback. Georgia can't beat the good teams because they don't have a quarterback. Penn State don't think they have a difference maker at quarterback. LSU shuffling quarterbacks left and right. And so I just think it's incredible. I think it speaks to the evolution of college football. I think it speaks to the fact that we are going to have a great Heisman race down the stretch. All right, I think that's it for this episode of the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. Told you I'd keep you out in 40 minutes. I'm at 48 and still going strong. So I think that's it for today's show. Great show, though. Fun show, though. I hope everybody enjoyed. Before we get out of here, I do want to remind you, please make sure that you are subscribed to the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast, iTunes, the Podcast Addict app, Podbean, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, wherever you listen to podcasts, make sure that you are subscribed to the Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. Make sure to rate and review the show. Go ahead and give us a quick 5 stars. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. All that good stuff. Make sure you're following on social media at @Aaron_Torres on Twitter, at @AaronTorresPod, where a lot of really good stuff going up on the Instagram page. And as mentioned, I did start that. The email mailing list. Go find me on Twitter. It's pinned to the top of my page. And I will also mention that in terms of a scheduling note, Tuesday's show expected to be really NBA draft heavy with the NBA draft on Wednesday. When I come back on Wednesday, I'll probably recap the NBA draft and then transition into whatever is going on in football at that time. But yeah, I think that's it for today's Aaron Torres Sports Podcast. I want to thank you for listening. But yeah, that's it. I will be back later this week. I will be back on Monday with an NBA draft preview. But before I go, you already know. Shout out to Torin Craig. Shout out to Rachel, who hates my voice. And I will be back later this week.